This is a quest really for reestablishing normalcy.
South Korea elects a new president. It's Wednesday, May 10th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're online right now on VOA Asia Facebook. Join us. Also ahead, U.S. members of Congress speak with the Dalai Lama. Blasphemy and politics in Indonesia. China faces more human rights questions. Going to Mars and food security on Earth. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Liberal Moon Jae-in has declared victory in South Korea's presidential election, vowing to represent all of the country's people. Exit polls indicated Moon had more than 41% of the vote, far ahead of his closest competitors, Liberty Korea Party candidate Hong Joon-pyo, who had 23%, and centrist People's Party candidate An Chol-soo, who gained 21%. Voter turnout was historically high, following a tumultuous political period in which revelations of ex-President Park Geun-hye's alleged multi-million-dollar influence peddling scheme led to weeks of massive public protests that pressured the National Assembly to force her removal from office and call for a new election. Korea Society Senior Director and Columbia University Professor Stephen Norper tells VOA's Victor Beatty voters have focused on domestic issues, but tensions with North Korea have loomed large.
The North Korean issue and issues of national security have figured more prominently than they have in recent elections, given North Korean provocations and concerns about rising tension around the peninsula.
Moon Jae-in, the former human rights lawyer, his victory would mean what for North Korea policy?
Well, Moon Jae-in has talked about something like a Sunshine 2, meaning an opening akin to the individual whom he worked for, Roh Moo-hyun, and his predecessor, Kim Dae-jung, meaning the opening to North Korea, incentives in terms of economic incentives and trying to find a way to deal with the North that is more pro-engagement. But Moon Jae-in has also conditioned that by saying that they'll need to see results from the North in exchange for the types of economic incentives that North Korea might be seeking. It is likely that Moon Jae-in will pursue a policy with North Korea that is contrary to where the more conservative administration has left off. The United States has an open-ended policy review, meaning they're allowing to adjust for the new realities of the new administration. But clearly, Moon Jae-in may have a softer line with North Korea. That could mean that we need a lot of extra effort at alliance management and frank discussion in terms of Korea-U.S. relations.
This is considered a special election. It's out of cycle because of the ouster of former President Park Geun-hye. Is this unprecedented? Is it unusual in South Korean politics?
It is in many ways, because there have been active demonstrations from October of last year through March of this year that had focused on the corruption scandal that had surrounded Park. And so this is a quest really for reestablishing normalcy. And so many South Korean voters are simply tired of the disruptions in the political system. They want accountability. They like the promise of transparency. They want an address to the economic concerns and the domestic agenda. And they want someone to deal more effectively with the North Korean issue, if at all possible. So there are a lot of demands, and it will be certainly a time that is historic in terms of a transition back to a more liberal government.
The new president will be sworn in later today once the vote tally becomes official. The wide margin of Moon's victory in the exit polls is unlikely to be so far off the official count to change the outcome. The U.S. State Department said Washington looks forward to continuing close, constructive, deep cooperation with South Korea's new leader. The new president will have to deal with erupting diplomatic crises with U.S. President Donald Trump's $1 billion demand for the THAAD missile defense system being deployed on the Korean Peninsula, and with China's economic retaliation against South Korea, limiting tourism and imports for supporting THAAD that Beijing sees as a threatening increase of the U.S. military presence in the region. More on our top story is found on Facebook at VOA Asia and the VOAnews.com website. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Moon Jae-in winner declares victory in South Korean election. China's President Xi says he'll uphold global climate deal. China rights lawyer recants torture allegations in high-profile case. Pakistan criticizes Iran for threatening cross-border military action. Rare ride to promote women's rights in Pakistan. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on our voanews.com website. We continue now with VOA Asia. A U.S. congressional delegation visited the Dalai Lama at his headquarters in India Tuesday, seeking to draw world attention to human rights in Tibet as President Donald Trump eyes warmer ties with China. House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi flew with a bipartisan delegation to the Himalayan hill town, where the 81-year-old Buddhist leader is based, on a trip likely to rile Beijing, which regards him as a dangerous divisionist. VOA Tibetan correspondent Nirbal Nirbal joins us with more on the visit and what was discussed.
This is actually an 8-member, high-level U.S. bipartisan, congressional delegation visit to Dharamsala, and they met with the Dalai Lama yesterday. Yesterday, they just had a more informal talk, and basically Dalai Lama said that Dharamsala, where he has lived for 58 years now, is his second home. But he also said, and when he thinks deeply about the situation inside Tibet, he reflects deeply on the situation inside Tibet, as well as in China, where he estimates there are over 400 million Buddhists there. So he thinks always about them very seriously. That's what he said, basically. Mm-hmm. And he thanked the U.S. congressional delegation for their visit again, especially for Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. For her, this is the second visit to Dharamsala, and she also visited Tibet in 2015, and she last visited Dharamsala in 2008, I think.
The official U.S. policy has one big China and really doesn't separate out Tibet, as a lot of exiled Tibetans would like to see happen. What would the Dalai Lama hope to get from meeting the congressional representatives? Some change in thought or policy? How can they really change from the direction that they've gone in?
Yeah, the Tibetans, and especially their leader, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, always hopes for the best. But this delegation, as most of the reports and also analysts, they say it comes at a very kind of critical time when President Donald Trump, whose rhetorics during the campaign and his policies and present situation, when he's seeking support from Chinese Xi Jinping to help him just restrict the North Korea. Such as situations, I think there's some kind of perception among the Tibetans that I think a cause for concern. And especially last week when U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, he reportedly played down the importance of human rights in the U.S. foreign policy. So I think there's some kind of concern among the Tibetans that how the U.S. Policy towards China and Tibet will shape out. Mm. So that's the one. This is the context in which now the president delegation has come. But I think especially the Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi has been the strongest voice in the United States Congress in support of Tibet. She has been very consistent and unchanging supporter of Tibet and Tibetan struggle. So her visit this time, Tibetans think they give a lot of significance to this visit, hoping for better situation later on under this administration.
And just because there's an official policy toward China and Tibet doesn't mean that there aren't members of the U.S. Congress that have very different views of how this should be handled.
Yeah, that's right. United States government's policy, actually, the Tibetans always look at the positive side of it, because the United States, the presidents of the past presidents of the United States always have met with the Dalai Lama, and they have expressed always strong support for the human rights situation in Tibet, and there's always strong call for on the Chinese government to have dialogue with the Dalai Lama and his representatives to resolve the Tibet issue. So that's one thing from the administration side. But in the Congress, from both the parties, there's a strong support for the Tibetans and Tibet human rights situation, calling on the United States, always reminding the government, United government, to do take a stronger stand on Tibet issue.
Norbul, from our Tibetan service, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
After Donald Trump's election last November, the Dalai Lama said he was keen to meet the incoming U.S. leader. It now appears unlikely the Nobel Peace Laureate will get a White House invitation anytime soon, an honor accorded by recent American presidents. Happening now in Asia, a new poll suggests confidence in the Southeast Asia-U.S. relationship is at a low point. The Singapore-based ASEAN Studies Center says roughly 43% of respondents said the Trump administration was not interested in Southeast Asia, compared to 37% who said it was. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us today. Jakarta's Chinese Christian governor, who lost his battle for re-election last month, on Tuesday was sentenced by an Indonesian court to 2 years in prison for blasphemy. Prosecutors had sought a 2-year suspended sentence for Basuki Cahaya Purnama, also known as Ahok. He was accused of insulting the holy book, the Quran. He has denied any wrongdoing, but the case has raised concerns about the state of religious tolerance in the world's most populous Muslim country. Australian National University Indonesia expert Peter McCauley tells VOA he was surprised by the verdict, given the long tradition of Indonesian judges following the recommendations of the prosecution.
Ahok has announced that he will appeal, which I guess would not be surprising. So this means that the issue will drag on yet for a while, perhaps for a month, perhaps for several months. We do need to bear in mind that a fairly amazing thing did happen in the election, and that is that Ahok, even though he is a double minority governor, that is, he is Chinese and Christian, which is a double minority in Indonesia, he still got close to 40% of the vote. But it is also true, the disappointing side of it is that certainly if he is imprisoned, this is disappointing and very worrying, and I'm surprised by it, quite frankly, because there is a tradition in Indonesia that people look for compromises, that he would be prosecuted, he would be sentenced to 2 years, but it would be suspended. That was the compromise. Now, it seems that the compromise has not stuck, and that indeed is worrying, so I can agree with Human Rights Watch on those grounds. It is not really a win for Islam so much as a win for fairly crude politics, which was supported by religiosity. The real message is that it was hard politics, and the hard politics which drew on religious support managed to get the extra vote. So a message certainly is that the religious vote is worth 5, maybe 10%, and it will embolden them to that extent. But there is very wide concern in Indonesia to keep what you might call strong, moderate policies. So I don't think we will lose that.
Before the controversy erupted, Purnama was widely praised for his decisive leadership style. He succeeded popular President Joko Widodo in 2014, who backed his re-election bid. Purnama will step down in October. You're listening to VOA Asia.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on the Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This news alert from VOA Asia. The United States has vowed to continue the alliance with South Korea to tackle threats from North Korea after Moon Jae-in declared victory in the South Korean presidential election. But experts tell VOA Moon's victory could lessen South Korean resolve to confront the North. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. A Chinese court released a transcript and video Monday showing human rights lawyer Xi Yang confessing to charges of subverting state power. Xi was caught up in a security crackdown in 2015 and held without formal charges until January 2016, when he was accused of inciting subversion. His wife, who is in the United States, insisted he had been tortured. Sophie Richardson of Human Rights Watch tells VOA the Xi case is a classic example of everything that's wrong with the Chinese judicial system.
Xi Yang is a human rights lawyer who has taken up cases defending in court other vulnerable people who are trying to get justice, typically against local officials. And in response to that, officials have cracked down on precisely this community of lawyers starting in July of 2015, when about 300 of these people were rounded up, detained. Some of them have been kept in detention since then. Some were disappeared. Some have been prosecuted. And those who've actually been subject to some kind of criminal proceedings have reported being ill-treated. They've been charged with crimes for which there is no credible evidence. They've been denied access to lawyers of their own choosing. And in Xie Yang's case, he accurately predicted that he would be tortured in detention, and that if he were eventually seen to be reading a statement admitting guilt.
Some reports say he was working on very politically sensitive cases, which Richardson says could mean many things.
But that really can range from exposing corruption by local or national leaders all the way through to defending particular faith-based communities the government doesn't like, the Falun Gong, the underground house Christians, Tibetans, Uyghurs. Xie had been involved in a number of very high-profile cases that I think brought him a particular kind of visibility, but along with a whole slew of other lawyers who had defended similar cases that maybe weren't quite as high profile, he came in for precisely the same kind of treatment.
Sophie Richardson of Human Rights Watch says the human rights situation in China is moving quickly.
Deteriorating facts. I think if you had asked us when Xi Jinping came to power, whether, you know, the only 300 human rights lawyers in the entire country get rounded up, whether the government would rather than embrace anti-corruption activists. See the Chinese government abducting from other countries or detaining inside China foreigners. You know, these are all serious pathologies that have worsened considerably, you know, largely as Xi seeks to, I think, distract attention away from a slowing economy and consolidate power ahead of the Party Congress this year to ensure him another smooth 5 years.
The U.S. State Department on Monday said it is deeply concerned about Xi's well-being and said his confession appeared to be given under duress. Xi's lawyer disappeared last week. The U.N. spoke out against his detention last week. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman said Monday the statement disregards objectivity and constitutes interference in China's domestic affairs and judicial sovereignty. Developing at this hour in Asia, Chinese President Xi Jinping told French President-elect Emmanuel Macron in a phone call Tuesday he would uphold the Paris Agreement on curbing climate change. China is the world's top emitter of greenhouse gases. U.S. President Donald Trump has expressed skepticism of China's pledge. Stay up to date on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, exploration of Mars is not proceeded without setbacks, but that did not discourage scientists trying to find the answer to one of the crucial questions. Has the red planet ever sustained life? If the answer is positive, it would mean that we are not alone in the universe. Scientists at the European Space Agency, ESA, have already moved on from last year's crash of their lander. VOA's George Pudish tells us that ESA is preparing its orbiting parent spacecraft to start looking for life-related gases.
The last part of the 2016 joint ESA-Roscosmos mission to Mars did not end well. The Schiaparelli probe crash-landed and never sent back a signal. But its parent spacecraft, the Trace Gas Orbiter, is still fully operational. After testing its instruments, scientists are now preparing to start looking for sources of methane and other gases on the surface. From a distance of 400 kilometers, it will require some complex science.
So it will be really a Sherlock Holmes work to try to put together a case for whether it's geological or biological activity that is responsible for the methane.
It will also require some complex maneuvers. The orbiter is flying much too fast to scan the Martian surface, so mission controllers have to slow it down and change its orbit from elliptical to circular. Trying to save on the thruster's fuel, scientists decided to use the ever-shifting Martian atmosphere to slow the orbiter.
We have to take a lot of margin to be sure that even if we go through a moment where the atmosphere is more dense at the altitude where we are flying, we are still safe with the spacecraft.
The orbiter should start sending its first measurements of Martian gases before the end of this year. In the meantime, engineers from European and Russian space agencies are busy building the next rover, which will fly to Mars in 2020 and looking for the best landing spot.
We want a site where we had liquid water present over hundreds of millions of years. And we want this liquid water to be what we call low energy or slow flowing water, like on the canals in Amsterdam.
Scientists hypothesize that conditions on the Martian surface billions of years ago were similar to the conditions on Earth when life started here. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
No matter where life is, it requires food. A new report from the World Food Program adds weight to the notion that human actions, as well as drought or natural disaster, can cause food insecurity and famine here on Earth. We hear the human reporting actions of VOA's Kevin Enix to learn more.
These Syrian refugees in the Bekaa Valley aren't here just because of the violence that has enveloped their country. They are here looking for food.
Because of the crisis, the conflict, people have to move. They have to find food. And when they can't find food, they're going to go wherever they can get it. And that's why you have migration. That's why you have people moving in the millions. And from Syria alone, you've got over 5 million that are refugees that have left the country. You have another 6 million, give or take, that are internally displaced. They've moved from their primary home, and they don't want to do that, but they've got to go where there's safety and when there's food.
A new study by the World Food Program puts numbers behind the notion that lack of food caused by conflict, as well as drought, is driving the movements of refugees. For every 1% increase in the amount of food insecurity, nearly 2% of a stressed community will leave in search of food. Eastern Africa, on the brink of massive famine, has seen years of both drought and conflict. In South Sudan alone, 2 million people have been driven from their homes in search of food.
I see only problems and destruction. What is left is crumbling with the rains.
And in neighboring Central African Republic, the WFP estimates half of the population needs food assistance. But the money's just not there.
We're only 7% funded right now. There's an opportunity for the Central African Republic. Some of the most vulnerable people in the world live in that country. 40% of the children there suffer from chronic malnutrition, which means they don't have regular access to food. We need to invest in the Central African Republic. We need to do it for tomorrow and for the longer term so that in the future, our job will be done.
The WFP says that more than 200 million people across Africa don't have enough food. Add in the Syrian refugee camps and the rest of the planet, and the World Food Program says that number jumps to nearly 800 million. Kevin Enix, VOA News, Washington.
We hope you are well wherever you are listening to VOA Asia. You can get our program anyways, too. iTunes and SoundCloud are good places to go. You can also download our podcast and take VOA Asia with you. We're on our website at voanews.com and, of course, on Facebook at VOA Asia. We'd like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, in the studio for helping us with today's program. Our managing editor is Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team includes Ali Ogden. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead. We'll be right back.